Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is overseas for a screening of a controversial film he made for the BBC 40 years ago about the Sydney Opera House that was willfully destroyed but has since been resurrected. Today, we have a star-studded lineup for you. We start with the debt and default crisis. The New Republic's Jonathan Cohen reports on the latest. Then Andrew Ross from NYU examines alternatives to debt, this time not government debt, but personal debt. And we close with Sara Aish of Greenpeace, who updates us on the seizure and imprisonment of the Arctic 30 by Russia. Joining us now is Jonathan Cohen, a senior editor at The New Republic. Previously, he was executive editor of The American Prospect, and he's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He has an article at The New Republic, which I've just read and is terrific, called The Republicans May Lose, But So Will You, and he tweets at Citizen Cohen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohen.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Great to have you. So, the government shutdown, this is like watching the World Series and it's, you know, the bottom of the ninth and it's the seventh game and who knows what's happening, right?
Right. I mean, I think at this point we kind of, you know, it looks like there's two outs and, you know, the team that's behind, you know, they got nobody on base down at their last strike. I mean, it looks like we see the end of this now, so hopefully we're done, but, you know, it isn't over till it's over. But we'll see.
And one of the people who may be over out of all of this is John Boehner. How do you read his conduct in the histrionics of the last few weeks, and where do you think he sits in the Republican heart?
So, you know, Boehner is a really interesting character. I mean, he's really the central character in some ways, more than, you know, when you think about who's the center of this story, more than anybody else, more than Ted Cruz, more than President Obama, this has really been about Speaker John Boehner. You know, I think Boehner, in his heart of hearts, is an old-school politician. He's very conservative, but also someone who's used to the sort of, you know, world where you make deals and you do things in the sort of normal way of business. And he's got, you know, he is in charge of a Republican caucus with a large number of members from the Tea Party who are, frankly, much more extreme ideologically and also much more extreme in terms of the tactics they endorse. And, you know, if you want to think about it this way, you know, we have a constitution that sets the rules for how Congress and the presidency operate, but there's also a kind of set of understandings about how they're going to govern and sort of good faith and when you compromise and make deals. And the sort of Tea Party wing of his party doesn't want to play by those rules. And, you know, they were the ones who came up with the idea of, hey, let's shut down the government and let's threaten not to raise the debt ceiling so that we'll default on our payments. And we'll threaten all this if we don't get what we want, which is to end the president's health care law. And Boehner, as the speaker, is in charge of these people and has to try to kind of corral them and get them, you know, keep them united against his better judgment, has basically deferred to them and let them call the plays. And I think he has done that in part because he's afraid. He thinks that if he doesn't, they have enough power to depose him as the speaker. So, that's basically how he got into this. And it's been a sort of amazing spectacle because, I mean, his lieutenants have said, we think this is a really bad idea and this is going to backfire. We're not going to win this fight. And yet they went ahead with it. And I think everybody sort of figured that he was going to do what he had done before, which is wait until the last possible minute, try everything they wanted him to try, and then he could come to them and say, hey, guys, I did it your way. I tried. We can't win on this. The American people aren't behind us. The president isn't going to negotiate with a gun to his head. We just have to go ahead and reopen the government and raise the debt ceiling. And that's what he did. But, you know, by waiting this long, they've done all sorts of damage to the American economy, I think to American credibility abroad. And, you know, you just have to wonder, did he have to wait so long? I mean, what could he have taken a harder stand at some point and basically confronted his caucus and sort of put on the line and said, look, I know you want this, but you can't have it. And if you want to depose me, depose me, but I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. It feels as though there's a lack of courage there, which is the last thing you're allowed to level as an accusation at a member of the Republican Party, apparently. Their masculinity is deeply compromised if you do so. But Jonathan Cohen, you've You've talked about this in terms of the damage that it will do to us as Americans, and despite my accent, I actually am one. What do you think the damage is domestically? Internationally, our reputation is in tatters, as incompetent and irrational, but it might have been like that for quite a while anyway. But domestically, what does it do for our sense of self and our sense of confidence?
Right. Well, so, you know, quite apart from, there are tangible economic costs to what we're doing. You know, Standard & Poor's just put out a sort of study that said they basically, if I'm remembering the number correctly, they think this drama, this shutdown, has cost us basically $25 billion in wealth. Now, that sounds like a lot in the grand scheme of things. $25 billion of an entire economy is not that much money, but it is something, and it does translate down. And so we've all paid a price. But I also think, again, you know, I think that as a country, we depend upon our leaders to work things out and to have, you know, I think it's good to have debates. It's good to have vigorous debates. I have no problem with the fact that there are people in this country who have very strong feelings on one way or the other, and that includes people who don't agree with me. You know, I'm a liberal. I understand the Tea Party arguments. I don't agree with them, but, you know, let's have these arguments. Let's debate these things. Let's debate them vigorously. Fine. But it's very, very important that everybody who is a part of that debate in Washington, the people who are elected to represent us, understand that they have a responsibility to act like adults, to say at some point, look, we can't just all sit in our corners and sort of stamp our feet and demand that things go the way we want to. And we need that to run. We need that to build, both for the sake of having a functioning government, but also, I think, for reminding all of us as Americans that we may disagree about things, but we're all part of the same country, and there's a sort of common set of beliefs, a common set of ideas. You know, somebody, I can't remember who now, originally said that, you know, really, you know, democracy is, you know, belief in democracy is sort of a religion in this country, and it requires everyone to sort of buy into it, you know, to buy into this idea that we're all part of the same society. We're going to have some give and take, but at the end of the day, that's going to work.
Now, Jonathan,
I feel like this has been a threat to that. This has been a challenge. That this is one group of people who are basically saying, we're not willing to engage in that give and take. We don't feel like that works for us. We have to have things our way. I mean, remember, this is all about the Tea Party. This all started because they don't like the health care law. A health care law that passed both houses of Congress and that was signed by a president who ran on a promise to pass the health care law. It was then upheld by the Supreme Court. And then there was a presidential election in which it was a very prominent issue. And the guy who signed the law ran against the guy promising to repeal the law. And the guy who signed the law won in a landslide. So, you know, the Democratic verdict on this law has been rendered. And it is time, I think, for the people who oppose that to recognize that. And if they want to repeal the law, fine. They can keep trying to repeal it. But, you know, until they repeal the law, it is the law of the land. And at some point, I feel like they need to understand that and be willing to move forward. And what I'm seeing here is a sort of statement that when you don't like the outcome of an election, when you don't like the way Congress votes, you know, you get to basically throw a temper tantrum and just stop everything from working until you get your way. And we can't have that.
Have that. Jonathan, we started by speaking about the impact that this would probably have on John Boehner. What about President Obama? And I ask because if we go back two decades and we think of when something similar happened between Newton Gingrich and William Jefferson Clinton, Clinton really won the day, hands down, and he did it by saying, I'm here to do the people's business. What are you doing? Has Obama had as straightforward and clear a message as Clinton did? And is he going to win the day as comprehensively, as hands down, as Clinton did?
You know, it's really hard to know. You know, the one thing that you have to say, the two things about Clinton were, number one, Clinton had the benefit of a really, really strongly growing economy. And political scientists will tell you that when you are looking at this sort of success of presidents, or any politicians, the economy is such a huge factor. And the economy is not as strong today. It is recovering from the recession. It's recovering steadily, but very slowly, and this is not going to help that. It's going to get a little weaker because of this episode. So Obama will not have that wind at his back. On the other hand, I think Obama has always benefited throughout his presidency, even at its lowest points, from a perception, a widely shared perception, that he is responsible, that he is a grown-up, that he is honest, and he is trying to do the right thing. There's a part of the country that has never accepted him, that really hates him, but it's a small part of the country, relatively speaking. Most Americans, even a lot of Americans who don't end up voting for him, they think he's basically a decent guy, and they trust him. They think he's a grown-up, you know, he's mature. And I think this episode reinforces that image, that, you know, he was the adult in the room, along with some other people. You know, he was trying to do the right thing, and we had these yahoos over here, you know, basically trying to wreck the government, wreck the economy in order to get their way. So I think he does pick up something from that. And I also think, you know, within Washington, this episode has really bound the different Democratic leaders to each other. It was really remarkable to watch the unity on display among the different branches. I mean, you had Nancy Pelosi, head of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. You had Harry Reid, head of the Democrats in the Senate, President Obama, and they spoke with one voice, and they coordinated. There was, you never heard about dissent among them. And within the two houses of Congress, you barely, almost never heard dissent among Democrats in the House or Democrats in the Republican. They spoke with Democrats in the Senate. They spoke with one voice. I actually think that is going to help the Democrats going forward, because these are habits in Washington. You know, when you're used to fighting with each other, you keep fighting with each other. When you start working together, it just feels more natural. And, you know, little things like the staff members get to know each other better. And there's just some trust that's been built up. I think that will help them going forward, because if you are united and the other party is full of divisions, as the Republicans are now, it's going to help to press their case. Maybe not in ways that's obvious to you know, out in public, but inside Washington, as issues move forward and they have to negotiate on things, I suspect that will help.
Jonathan Cohn, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, a senior editor at The New Republic. Previously, he was executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He has an article in The New Republic recently, The Republicans May Lose, But So Will You, and he tweets at Citizen Cohn. We'll take a break now for station identification, and then we'll be back to discuss personal debt and student debt with NYU's Andrew Ross.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding axes.
All my funds are gone and the bank says no. I beg in the places where I used to be. And I'm crazy for cash, but I ain't got none. Oh, I'm just paying my rent every day. Oh, and there's a hour of debt.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. Joining us now is Andrew Ross, who is Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's written for The New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice, and is also author and editor of many, many books, including, fairly recently, The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. Welcome to the program, Andrew Ross.
Thank you, Toby.
So, are times particularly precarious right now?
To say the least, yes. Although I think it does take a bunch of very, very crazy politicians to, you know, expose some truths at the very core of the global financial economy, which is what's been happening on Capitol Hill in the last week or so. the very rapid erosion of trust in what is a pillar of the global economy, the almighty dollar, and the U.S. Treasury in particular, I think has come as a big surprise to people. And it's just one more milestone, perhaps, in the continuing decline or erosion of American dominance in the world at large. The many ways of interpreting the milestone, I'm sure, but precarious is certainly a good code word for what's been going on.
A few years ago, some of us thought the euro might be a threat to the dollar as the reserve currency, but now the Chinese are actually publicly advocating that they step in and become the reserve currency.
Well, I think perhaps prematurely, but who knows, in 50 years' time, that claim may look a lot different. But certainly for the time being, there's far too much invested, both economically and also psychologically, too much invested in the dollar for that to happen. I think if there was a transition to some other currency, it would have to be a much more sober one, that it wouldn't be a transition that would happen as a result of some, emergency of the sort that, we might have been facing, we might still face, depending on how the House votes. But maybe 50 years' time, the Chinese claim will look different.
Now, in terms of the debt issue, which is what we're alluding to in part, my understanding is that you have a book coming out fairly soon on that topic. Could you tell us what the book is?
Well, the book is called Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal. And it's, as the title suggests, there's really two components to it. One is to describe the society that we now live in, which I call a creditocracy, and that's one in which government or the holding of power in the interest of a creditor class is the dominant form of government. Or to put it another way, it's a society where even the most basic or vital needs are required to be debt financed. So increasingly we find that the bare requirements of life for many Americans are things that they have to take on debt in order to have access to. That's a kind of society I describe as a creditocracy. The other part of it, the other component, is the case for debt refusal, which the book argues really is that under these circumstances, it's not only an act of civil disobedience, legitimate civil disobedience, to refuse or repudiate household debts. It may be the only way of restoring popular democracy in a country like this. So there are many moral and legal arguments that the book explores that underpin the case it's making for debt repudiation, specifically of household debts.
Can you explain to us what you mean by debt repudiation? It sounds good if I can sign up for it.
Well, the case has already been made for the sovereign debts of many countries in the global south that are perceived to have been delivered into a debt trap that they can't escape. The sovereign debts of many global south countries are a burden that weighs upon the prospects for development. And so at a certain point, for the last 20 years or so, groups have been lobbying the major creditor powers in the north for debt cancellation. And so that case has been made, and although a lot of the promises have yet to be fulfilled, there has been some degree of debt repudiation or debt cancellation for the global south. In Europe right now, in the eurozone, there's a similar case being argued for the repudiation of the external debts that were incurred specifically by Mediterranean countries in the eurozone, like Greece and Spain, Italy and Ireland and Portugal. What we haven't seen yet, although we're beginning to see, is a case being made for repudiation of household debts. And that's what the book takes on, really. It's try and build on these previous campaigns that argue that it's a legitimate and an honorable thing to refuse debts imposed by foreign bondholders and banks. and apply that to household debts like education debt or medical debt or even housing debt, credit card debt.
Now, you say that it's an honorable thing to do. Can you explain the case for that?
Well, in the case of odious debt, for example, which is sort of recognized internationally, where, let's say, an authoritarian government or a dictator takes out loans on behalf of his or her country, often diverts the funds into their own bank accounts so that, in fact, the money doesn't really have to travel very far because it's coming from banks in the north and it's getting deposited in the accounts of the dictators in the north. These kinds of debts are referred to as odious debts, and a successor government can make the case that they shouldn't be paid because they weren't the result of a sovereign or democratic process. There are other kinds of illegitimate debt, people have argued, debts that are used to generate environmental damage, debts that are made that when the creditor knows they can never possibly be repaid, debts that are made and negotiated by corrupt officials. When you break it down and you do a proper kind of debt auditing, you can figure out which debts should be paid, which debts are legitimate, and those that are illegitimate. And the mechanism for doing that is to do a citizen debt audit, which is becoming a sort of popular thing to do in Europe these days. It can be done at every level, at almost every institution. For example, in this country, there are efforts to audit the municipal debts of cities like Detroit, which are being held to ransom by Wall Street banks that sold very dodgy or toxic loan products to municipal officers. But it can also be done of institutions like utilities or universities. Nonprofit institutions that have been sold a bill of goods, let's say by a Wall Street bank, which is very common, and so the members of these institutions are being asked to to assume the costs, the burden of the debts, illegitimately.
I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. He's published in the New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice. He's also author and editor of numerous books, including The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. He's talking about a forthcoming book, which I think I've got the right title of, Andrew, Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, in terms of alternatives, you've outlined a few of those for us. What are the pressure points that activists and, in a sense, alternative economists, as it were, are able to apply? Where are the weak spots in terms of governments and the financial institutions that are clearly rotting the system?
Well, in so far as there does exist regulatory channels between government and the major financial institutions, it's pretty clear that something has broken down there, and that the major banks are beyond regulation, so to speak. In fact, earlier this year, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder actually confessed to the Senate Judiciary Committee that the banks really have too much concentrated power. It's difficult for us to prosecute them, he said. If you do bring a criminal charge, it has a negative impact on the national economy and perhaps even the global economy. And I think that was a very important moment. Some people might think it refreshing. Others might think it alarming, you know, to hear that the nation's top law enforcement official acknowledged that he was legally helpless in the face of these too big to fail banks, that there is no possibility that they can be regulated. We don't expect that much from elected officials at this point. They've had 5 years to pass tighter regulation. And they've also had 5 years to deliver debt relief to American households that are severely burdened. The record has been very thin. The banks have only gotten bigger and more powerful. And there's been virtually no effort at systematic debt relief. So looking to government at this point in time is not going to produce a lot of results, and it'll be a waste of energy for a lot of people.
So that suggests direct action as an alternative, is that right?
Well, yes, I think, and some of the groups that I've been involved in, debt resistance groups, Strike Debt in particular is a group that I work with, which is an Occupy offshoot. We basically believe that people have to take debt relief for themselves by any means necessary, and that can take a variety of channels. But it's very much in keeping with the Occupy ethos that, you know, our elected officials are very much in the pocket of the creditor class and are not in a position to pass reforms or legislation that counters the interests of the creditor class. And so direct action, civil disobedience, building alternative kinds of economies, these are the kinds of pathways that we need to follow if we're going to see any real change.
And you say that some of these activities in these groups emerged out of Occupy. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit more about that. First of all, tell us what happened to Occupy, and then secondly, tell us about the new formation.
Well, everyone has their own story about Occupy. I think you'll find that the ethos and many of the tactics of Occupy are still nourishing the work of various groups. It certainly does. That certainly is the case with Strike Debt, which is an alliance that came together last year of various Occupy groups dedicated to building a debtors' movement. Two of the things I think we're more well known for in Strike Debt, I could mention perhaps. One is something called the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, which you can download from our website, strikedebt.org. And that's a very useful volume that gives advice to debtors about how to renegotiate their debts or evict the power of debtors from their daily lives. The other project that became quite well known is something called the Rolling Jubilee. We raise money and we abolish debt that is purchased on the secondary debt marketplace. Distressed debt will be sold for pennies on the dollar to debt collectors, and then the debt collectors basically try to collect on the full amount of the debt. What we do is we go in and we buy the debt very cheaply and then abolish it, so the debtors are off the hook. It barely makes a dent, of course, in the volume of secondary debt. It's not supposed to be a solution to the debt crisis, but it's a kind of act of public education. And as a result of what we've been doing with the Rolling Jubilee, a lot more people are aware of how cheaply their debts have been bought. And so when the debt collector harasses you on the phone and you know how cheaply he or she has bought your debt for, you probably have a different attitude towards paying back what they're asking. So it changes the psychology of the debtor just knowing how that secondary debt marketplace works.
And that kind of information is probably going to assist with a particular word that I think a lot of folks perhaps struggle with who are in debt, namely shame. There is such a dreadful stereotyping in the bourgeois media of people in debt in this country that is quite antithetical to, as you said, the complete reliance on a debt culture as part of the fabric of the social order. I wondered if I could ask you in the last couple of minutes to talk about a particular area that I know you're an expert in, along with these other domains of debt, and that's specifically student debt. Where are we with that? Last time I looked, I think it was at somewhere around $1 trillion, wasn't it?
It will be approaching $1.2 trillion probably by the end of the year, yes. And that's awful. If you watch what Capitol Hill does, I mean, one of the more cruel and inhumane spectator sports this summer was watching congressional representatives debate whether to raise or lower interest rates by a point or two. It's an appalling thing to have to watch, but that's the that's the state of government action on this issue. And this is a year in which government profit from federal student loans is estimated at $51 billion. That's difficult for people to understand how the government can profit from a federal loan program and plow the profits not into education but into paying down the federal debt. In other words, paying off wars, the cost of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know time is short, so I'll just say one thing about this, Toby. I think everyone knows how expensive college is, but hardly anyone knows how cheap a free system would be. And one of our estimates of straight debt is that if you eliminated the long list of tax credits and exemptions that currently subsidize the student loan system, you would save more than $37 billion. Students spend about $60 billion on tuition at public colleges and universities. So if you subtracted all of the existing credits and exemptions at $37 billion, and if you reclaimed the money that's inappropriately allocated to for-profit colleges, you get savings of, you know, more than $47 billion, which leaves just $12.5 billion to be accounted for. I mean, that's all it would take, a little over $12 billion a year in additional funding to make public education in this country entirely free. That's a very paltry sum when you put it into the federal budget, when you put it alongside the tens of billions of dollars that are unaccounted for in the defense spending system or any other, you know, large item that might strike your listeners as inappropriate.
Sure.
And so it really wouldn't cost very much to cover the tuition of every student at 2- and 4-year public colleges in this country and allow the U.S. to join the long list of countries that do offer free higher education. It's something that's very little known.
What would that mean, just quickly, for private educational institutions and for-profit ones?
Well, it's a good question. It would mean that they would be the gap in price between, you know, top public colleges and many private colleges is getting smaller and smaller. And one of the things that one of the reasons why private colleges have been able to maintain their high tuition levels is because they're not all that much more expensive these days than good public universities. So making public education entirely free would certainly have an impact on how private universities did their business. But the private sector really is something that is highly subsidized, of course, by federal loans. I mean, the largest source of revenue in private universities is through the federal loan system. So it certainly would have an impact. On the for-profit system, well, I'm one of those educators that believes that the for-profit system shouldn't exist at all. I think it fails to perform on almost every metric, and it's inimical to my idea of education that people would profit from offering these services in the first place. So I'd be quite happy to see the for-profit sector disappear.
And so say all of us. Andrew Ross, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Toby.
I've been speaking with Andrew Ross, Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's published in the New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice, and he's author and editor of numerous books, which include The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. His forthcoming volume is entitled Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal. We'll take a break for station identification, and then joining us after that will be Sara Aish from Greenpeace to talk about the Arctic 30. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm joined now by Sara Ayesh, a climate and oil campaigner at Greenpeace UK, the founder of Transition Dartmouth Park and a social reporter for the Transition Network. She's currently working on Greenpeace's Save the Arctic campaign, which aims to prevent oil drilling and industrial fishing in the Arctic by having the region recognised as a world park. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sara Ayesh.
Hi, Toby. Nice to be here.
Now, you say nice to be here, but I realise times are very tough for Greenpeace at the moment, specifically in the Arctic. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yes, we've been we've obviously been running a campaign for about a year and a half called Save the Arctic, where we're aiming to get the area around the North Pole recognised as a global sanctuary and to prevent oil drilling, which would be hugely destructive for this pristine and beautiful region. The Russian oil company Gazprom are going to be the first to drill, to extract the first drops of oil actually in the Russian Arctic. They're about to do that very soon. Nearly a month ago, our ship, the Arctic Sunrise, went up there to make a peaceful protest against the oil drilling, which we feel could be catastrophic if there were spills. And what happened was they began this peaceful protest, and the Coast Guard in the area behaved very aggressively towards them. They were climbing up the oil rig. The Coast Guard, you know, pulled them down, fired warning shots towards them, fired shots in the water, and threatened them with knives. 24 hours later, FSB, which is Russian Security Service, officers landed on the deck of our ship while it was traveling in international waters, and basically forced everyone onto the deck at gunpoint. Our protesters, which can be seen in the photos, had their hands up. They behaved peacefully at all times. They were entirely unarmed, and the FSB officers were very heavily armed. They seized our ship. They took it back to Murmansk, which is a Russian Arctic port. And since then, for the last 28 days, are the 28 activists who are on board the ship and the two journalists who were with them, a photographer and a videographer, have been held in prison in Murmansk, and all 30 of them are charged with piracy. Piracy is a violent crime which carries 15 years maximum in jail. These are protesters who were peaceful, who were acting for the good of the world, who were acting not for personal gain. And we're demanding their immediate release.
I also read that the Russians claim to have found illegal drugs on board.
Yes, we absolutely deny that claim. There was morphine on board, which is part of a legally required medical kit. It was a Dutch ship, and the Dutch regulations demand that there is a medical kit on board. So we were abiding by those regulations. The last port that the ship was in before it was seized by the Russian security was Norway. And before it left Norway, the ship was searched for drugs, including use of sniff dogs. Nothing was found, and the Norwegian authorities have released documentation backing that claim up.
And in terms of what happens next, what is Greenpeace doing, and what have been the reactions from family members, from other non-government organisations, from governments and so on? Let's start with you guys. What are you up to in response to this?
So we're doing everything we can all over the world to try and use legal means to get the release of our peaceful colleagues and friends. We've held global days of solidarity all over the world, vigils at embassies, protests in town squares, protests at football games that are sponsored by the oil company in question, Gazprom. We have a petition all over the world on our website asking people to email their national Russian embassy, which is at nearly 1.5 million people in the last 28 days have signed that petition. And we're also asking all of the governments, the people on board were from 18 different countries. So we're asking our governments to provide consular assistance to those people. Their families, obviously, we're all really worried about them. Their families are. They're not being kept in very good conditions. They've described cold cells, solitary confinement, being locked up 23 hours a day. So, yes, we're very worried about them.
And what's your next tactic? What will you try to do? Or are you in a holding moment when you wait and see what happens legally?
Well, they've been charged with piracy, and we're obviously waiting to hear the results of the investigation, whether those charges will be continued or whether they'll be dropped. We've had a lot of support from many other NGOs around the world and other actors in civil society. Today, the Mothers of the Disappeared group in Argentina wrote a letter to President Putin. I know the grandson of Gandhi has spoken out about the need for a peaceful protest. Today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel personally telephoned Putin to ask for the release, to ask for a quick resolution to this matter. President Putin himself has publicly said that the protesters are not pirates. So we just really hope that the investigative committee releases them as soon as possible.
It's indeed an awful situation. It must be very difficult. Now, I happen to know that you have spent time on this ship. I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about what goes on there and what it does and what life is like on the Arctic Sunrise.
Absolutely. I was there. I was on the Arctic Sunrise a year ago. It's a ship that Greenpeace has had, I think, for about 20 years. We actually bought it under a different name from a company that had previously used it as a seal hunting ship. They didn't want to sell it to us, so we bought it under a different name other than Greenpeace and transformed it into what we now know as the Arctic Sunrise. I was there visiting the Arctic at the time of the sea ice minimum, which is the time in the year where the ice that is melting in the Arctic melts to its lowest point of the year. Last year, it melted to its lowest ever point, and we took scientists and journalists up there to bear witness to it and to conduct scientific research. And because I've been on that ship, I know it well. I know some of the crew who are traveling on it too. I sailed with them last year. It can hold about 30 people, and obviously over a trip, you become friends with people. You find out about their lives, the places they're from. It's a really wonderful environment to be with people who are from all around the world who really just want to make a difference. The ship is also used for protests for our campaigns. So it's been used for oceans campaigns. This spring, it did a tour of France and the UK where it supported sustainable fishermen and highlighted their struggle against the huge industrial fishing companies to keep their livelihoods.
I'm speaking with Sarah.
Yeah, and I know this shit well, and it feels personal to me.
I can well imagine. I'm speaking with Sarah Aish, a climate and oil campaigner at Greenpeace UK, who is also founder of Transition Dartmouth Park and a social reporter for the Transition Network. She currently works on Greenpeace's Save the Arctic campaign, which aims to prevent oil drilling and industrial fishing in the Arctic by having the region recognised as a world park. In terms of the World Park campaign, Sarah, could you tell us a little bit about what that would mean? It's actually not an expression I'm familiar with, I must admit.
Yeah, so basically, it's not the whole of the Arctic. Much of the Arctic belongs to the countries that border it, and 4 million people live in different parts of the Arctic. What our campaign is about is specifically the area around the North Pole, what's known as the High Arctic, which is the area that belongs to nobody. And we're asking for it to be made a global sanctuary, much like the one in Antarctica, which we campaigned for and won 15 years ago, where the area can't be exploited, where there's an international treaty where the area cannot be exploited for industrial purposes and can't be destroyed by oil drilling, which would inevitably cause, because of the inhospitable conditions there and the weather and the ice, if there were oil spills there, which would be likely, it would be impossible to clean up, and it would destroy the unique wildlife such as polar bears and narwhals that live there.
And of course, to get that status of a world park, is that something that comes through the United Nations?
It could potentially come a number of different ways, and the sorts of things we're doing at the moment are talking to individual Arctic nations. The Arctic nations have a body called the Arctic Council, which currently makes policy for the region. Finland was the first country a couple of months ago to come out and say that they supported the idea of a sanctuary around the North Pole. So what we're trying to do at the moment is build on that, work with other countries, ask people to lobby their governments, and it may be one treaty, it may be a series of bilateral treaties in the end.
Right, and then they amount to the idea of a world park because you have a mixture of multilateral arrangements and bilateral agreements and so forth. Yeah, very, very complicated patchwork of policy innovations that is necessary, I guess, to create, right? It's a long, slow burn.
Absolutely. And I think our focus at the moment is making the campaign as big and as well-known as possible. Over 4 million people have signed up to it around the world so far, and we want world leaders to know that everybody in the world cares about the Arctic. It's going to affect everybody in the world if it's destroyed. The melting ice is already, scientists have said, affecting our weather systems. And so for leaders to recognise this and for them to take action, it's important that as many people as possible around the world are on board with this.
And it's only, last week or the week before, I think, we had the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this body of eminent experts that operates through the United Nations, and they seem yet again to be giving us indisputable proof of the reality of climate change and the specificities of what that means for an area like the Arctic, right?
Absolutely. And a really clear message from the IPCC was that really we need to switch to renewable forms of energy. We need to start leaving fossil fuels in the ground. Arctic oil is very economically marginal. It's the last oil you would go and get. It's not going to come on stream in any kind of a big way for a very long time, well beyond the time where we should really still be using fossil fuels. And therefore, it just seems like madness that big oil companies like Shell and like Gazprom are leading this Arctic oil rush, spending billions of pounds, and they risk wrecking the region for what is only actually an estimated 3 years global oil supply.
It seems like an extraordinary thing to be doing, and yet they are doing it. How do you read the Russian mentality on this?
In terms of oil drilling, it's not just a Russian mentality. I mean, Shell tried to drill last year in Alaska, and although they broke both their oil rigs and their oil spill response equipment, they're now fixing it. We don't know if it will be fixed by next year, but they've publicly said that they plan to go back to Alaska. Russian oil companies like Gazprom and Rosneft are making deals with Western oil companies like BP and Shell. Shell are currently considering a partnership with Gazprom, the company in this case that seems to be putting the pressure on for the Arctic 30 to be detained in Russia in this way. So I think it's not just a Russian mentality. It's a big oil business mentality, and I guess it kind of raises a lot of questions about how far they will go, like how much they're going to disregard safety, how much they're going to disregard wildlife, and what a company like Shell would do next year if they had that partnership going with Gazprom and the same sort of protest happened. You know, would they like willingly see people locked up for that?
Sure. And you mentioned the expression the Arctic 30. I wonder if you've given us an idea of what that means. But this is the term that's being used to describe the 28 Greenpeace workers, activists, volunteers, and the two journalists who were on the Arctic Sunrise and have been placed under arrest by the Russian authorities, yeah, the Arctic 30. So for those people who may be listening who are unfamiliar with the story up to now, it hasn't got that much coverage here in the US. How can they participate in terms of the two petitions you mentioned? First of all, the petition about the Arctic 30, or the Greenpeace Arctic 30, as they're sometimes called, and secondly, the petition about turning the Arctic into a world park.
So anybody listening can go to savethearctic.org, which is the global website, and both petitions are on that website. Or you can go to the US Greenpeace website, and both petitions are on that website as well. And the full story of the Arctic 30, all of the individuals that were on there, two of whom are US citizens, are also on those websites. And then, like, one of the most, I guess, interesting people on the ship, Captain Peter Wilcox, he's a US citizen. He's been working for Greenpeace for over 25 years. And he was also the captain of our former ship, the Rainbow Warrior, when it was bombed by French secret agents in New Zealand in 1985. He survived that bombing. One of the crew was killed in it. And he went on, he continued being part of Greenpeace campaigns. He continued being a captain of Greenpeace ships. And now he's one of the Arctic 30 locked in a jail cell in Russia.
Quite a story. A tragedy, but one that isn't over yet, and many struggles to come. Sarah, one of the things that I gather Greenpeace is engaging in right now is that this Friday there's going to be a particular event. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, Friday will mark the 30th day since the Arctic 30 were detained in Russia, since the ship was seized by the Russian Coast Guard. So it will be the 30th day that they spend in detention. And we're going to mark that all over the world with a global day of solidarity. We held a global day of solidarity about 10 days ago, and it was we had a really amazing response. It happened in over 200 locations around the world. In London, there were about 1,000 people, including celebrities. And it happened in 24 places across the UK. I know that it also happened in several locations in America, including Washington and Los Angeles and San Francisco. This Friday, we'll have another day of action, which so far I think is happening in 45 countries around the world. And it will be a variety of things. It will be things highlighting the fact that it's 30 people and it's 30 days. In London, we're having a candle-lit vigil, and I believe there will also be events happening in the US.
Well, that sounds very spectacular, and it needs to be in the context of this appalling infringement of human rights. Do you have
any... Absolutely. This week alone, all of the Arctic 30, the 28 activists and the two journalists have been appearing in court requesting bail and have been refused bail. All of them so far who've appeared in court have been refused bail. The protesters, they pose no threat to anybody, and the organisation has offered a guarantee. Our chief executive has offered to move to Russia in order to offer himself as a personal guarantee if they are released, and that has been rejected.
And Sarah, how can people find out about the Global Day of Solidarity and Action?
Well, different sorts of things are happening in different places. What I would recommend is that wherever you are, you go on to the Greenpeace USA website or the SaveTheArctic.org website, and you can take action by signing the petition to the Russian embassy. And if you follow any of the Greenpeace Facebook pages, there'll be a series of things that we ask you to do to share this action with your friends and at various times to join these days of solidarity.
Can't think of a better thing to be doing. Sarah Aish, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Sarah Aish, a climate and oil campaigner at Greenpeace UK, the founder of Transition Dartmouth Park, and a social reporter for the Transition Network. She's currently working on Greenpeace's Save the Arctic campaign, which aims to prevent oil drilling and industrial fishing in the Arctic by having the region recognised as a world park. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. He'll be back next Monday. The programme is available at ianmasters.com. I'll return tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Thanks to Graham Fitzgibbon in the soundproof booth for production services, and bye for now.